All right. Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the House of the Risen Sun with Bruce Rawls and Lynn Johnson. And here we just talk about what it is to live in the House of the Risen Sun, which is a pretty dang good place to be. And I'm looking out my window and the sun just came up and it's probably coming up in your part of the world too. And it's a perfect time for that. So good morning, Bruce. How are you this morning?
Good morning, Lynn and everyone. I'm fine. And, the, it's light out, but it's a little overcast today. Is it not unusual for a, Oregon coastal morning in the summer? But, very pleasant though.
Well, I envy you that. We're a little overcast too. We've been having cooler weather. It's very strange. We have a weird weather in Colorado. So, and I think all over the world. And of course we call it weird because it's different than what we, we experienced before. But when have we ever experienced the same thing twice?
Yeah, exactly. Lightning never strikes twice in the same place, but I think that's part of the ego's dualistic thought system is it always keeps changing, so it seems to be a different thing that we need to address, and yet it's always the choice in the mind for one or two thought systems, huh?
It's so simple. It's so simple, and when you see how it's just so repetitive over and over and over and over, and I was just looking yesterday at some things that I had done in my previous life, you know, as a professional and a scientist and an engineer. And, you know, I was, you know, looking at all these things and thinking, how could I have thought this was so important? And why would I have put myself, I was thinking actually about, for 3 years, I live in Pueblo, Colorado, which is in southern Colorado, and I worked in Englewood, which is, up in the Denver area. So, it was 101 miles. Every day I had to drive to work and then back home from work. So, you know, over 200 miles a day just to get to work and back home. And, you know, the sacrifices that I made for that job and the things that I thought, were so very important that I was doing and, you know, I just thought that it was so worth it, everything. And of course, you know, they fired me and, that's another story. I got fired from 3 jobs in a row, over the period of a couple of years. And, it really kind of shook my thoughts. And made me realize, oh, this thing I think I'm supposed to be doing is completely not what I'm supposed to be doing. But it wasn't until I got into a terrible car accident that I realized, okay, I guess I'm really not supposed to be doing this. So, you know, I was looking at those things and thinking about how important I thought they were. And we're in the section of the workbook. We're starting part 2 of the workbook and we're into, the section of, what is forgiveness. We're looking at all the different, new meanings that Jesus has given to, so many of the things that we thought we knew before. And, this idea of what is forgiveness, I was really looking at that and thinking about my life and thinking about all the things that, I believed were true. And of course, that's what this is telling us to do is, you know, you don't have to do anything. You just have to look at your thoughts and ask about them. Ask, what is this real? Is this true? And, it's so easy to let it go when you do that. But, it's amazing time in the world. It's an amazing time with what's happening with politics, weather, social, cultural. I mean, whole countries are changing. You know, places are burning down. You probably got some fires going on in your place. That's my daughter. But anyway, I'm going to let go of the mic. I'm just going to mute my mic and talk to my daughter for a minute.
Okay.
Over to you to do whatever you like.
Okay. All righty. Thanks, Lynn. Yeah, you mentioned fires and certainly the current events can be very enthralling and give us plenty to keep us busy. You know, I oftentimes use the phrase firefighting as a metaphor for the way that the ego is constantly keeping us busy, because there's always some kind of fire to put out. On the level of form, on the Oregon coast here, we are surrounded by national forest on the east and the ocean on the west. So, you know, we have plenty of burnable stuff here, but fortunately the moisture keeps the forested area around us pretty damp most of the time, although this is kind of a slight drought here compared to some other places. But so we're fortunate that we don't have a lot of smoke typically, and certainly not the heat because of the coastal fog that comes in all the time. But but the firefighting aspect, I think, is, again, to kind of gently but firmly segue back to the purpose of our conversation, which is to, you know, look at the thought system in our mind that we're choosing at any moment. And the ego's insanity is basically to keep us completely enthralled, completely obsessed and compulsively focused on the outside world. And our whole sensory apparatus is designed for that. We have ears, eyes, nose, tongue, you know, the whole, you know, the tactile, everything is designed to make us, seem, you know, certainly even just with the word us, there appears to be more than one of us, but our sensory data even further reinforces that by giving us, data that, and it's completely socially acceptable to believe that everything that we're experiencing is a result of something that's outside of ourselves. And yet this wonderfully radical curriculum called A Course in Miracles, which is just one of an infinite number of pure non-dual metaphysical systems in the cosmos, I'm sure, because that information is available to everyone everywhere, because it's our true nature, suggests that the data that comes back to us is really just the result of a choice in the mind for a thought system of either duality or oneness. And we think duality has still something to offer us because we keep trying to make it work, you know, the beating the dead horse kind of thing. But we're always firefighting. We're always out there on the front lines of the blazes, putting out the next most important thing to the what's in it for me character, the stick figure, the puppet, the actor on the screen, actor or actress on the screen, that, you know, these are the characters that people our lives. And we almost always forget that the drama that we're so enamored with is really just to keep us mindless. And that's the whole purpose of it. And we keep ourselves mindless because we don't want to see, as egos, that there really is nothing in truth that's wrong. On the level of form, there's all kinds of crazy stuff going on, because this world is designed to keep us forever looking outside and distracted and diverted and dissociated. And, you know, that's the split mind idea that A Course in Miracles suggests is really what we need to heal, not by trying to illuminate this world and make this world, you know, reflect the reality, because it never will. But we can make our mind, we can choose in our mind the thought system of inclusion and oneness and shared interest and kindness, and then it does reflect, it does manifest. I was actually reading in Ken Wapnick's A Journey Home book this morning about kind of the new age idea of manifesting. And I really like what he shared about that, which is that we're always manifesting. We're always manifesting one of two thought systems. You know, the typical new age idea is basically decide as an ego what you want in the world. And which is always a moving target and always constantly changing because the landscape is always changing, but then go after that and try to keep up with the changing needs and the changing wants. And, it, you know, it's a, It's basically another Sisyphus story of the Greek mythological character who was condemned forever to push this heavy boulder up to the top of the mountain, only to have it come crashing down on him and having to start over again. And Ken Wapnick talks about that in his wonderful little booklet and audio about how silly it is to the folly of trying to make the dream work. On it's as Sisyphus as every man, I think, is the subtitle. And maybe I can find the let's see, what is it? Oh, it's what was the name of that anyway? But from futility to happiness. That's the audio and booklet that Ken wrote about the Sisyphus story. But that's our firefighting episode that we engage in moment to moment to moment, unless we just stop, at each moment and say, is this what I really want? Could I see peace in this?
Exactly. And that's exactly what Jesus is asking us in this section. What is forgiveness? Is, look at all these things you think are happening and, just stop a minute and look and ask, is this really true? Is this, are these mistakes really happening? Is, and you do begin to see that it's, none of it is true at all. Mm-hmm. And that whole little doing the same thing over and over and over and expecting different results.
Right. The classic cliche, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we've got all the pointers that tell us that that's what we're doing. And we know that's what we're doing. Whenever I find myself, getting stuck in some thought situation where I'm imagining, some mistake has happened, something has gone wrong, there's a problem, every single time if I just stop for a moment, and as Jesus is asking us in the introduction, what is forgiveness part of the workbook, he's asking us, just stop and look at that. Look at what you're thinking and ask the question. It really becomes very clear if you just stop and look. But what we do instead of doing that is we say, oh, there's a problem. Something is happening. I need to find a solution. Let me come up with a plan. Let me figure this out. Oh, this is not working. That is not working. Holy Spirit, will you help me now? we get through, where we're just all, beyond our ability to do. And then we remember, oh, wait a minute. There's somebody who already told me they were going to help me with this. And that's really all you need to do is just stop. Mm-hmm. And the solution is there for you.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just right there.
Yep.
But what we do is we get more and more wound up in it. And as that happens, the world appears to be more and more and more insane because we're so, I think, entertained by the insanity.
Yeah, but it's kind of it's kind of like being addicted to horror movies. There may be parts where things seem to go nicely, but we know it never turns out well. It's always a tragic comic kind of thing, and we're never peaceful. There's always this sort of white knuckle thing in the theater. Knowing that when the eerie music starts to swell, that there's going to be something not so great about to happen, and that kind of thing. But that's how we set it up because we think that we committed some cosmic crime. And so we're just waiting for the other Monty Python, shoe to drop out of the sky, so to speak. But that's the ego's, lot in life. It's basically, the attack, retreat, defense, attack cycle that's all basically foisted upon us when we choose that thought system as a result of believing in the idea that sin, guilt, and fear is possible. And if we never question that, then of course we're just in that endless treadmill, aren't we?
Exactly. And so the most important thing you can do is question your thoughts. And the more I do it, the more I see how silly they really are. how ridiculous sometimes some of the solutions that I come up with or, you know, what I think would be the best thing to do. And I'll give people advice sometimes, even, oh, well, you should try this or do that. And like somehow I have some expertise and they'll listen because sometimes I do say things that are wise. So I got to really watch it that I'm not making up the story myself, but I'm really listening to what the Holy Spirit, you know, has to say about it. And, you know, you can't change the situation, but you can change your mind about the situation. And changing your mind about the situation actually does change the situation. Mm-hmm. The healing that comes about, you know, and I have seen actual, you know, things physically change in the world, in ways that are unexpected because, not because I changed my mind, more than likely because I decided to go to another part of the script where things were a little gentler because I recognized that I didn't deserve to be attacked or punished by myself or the world. But as long as I think I deserve to be attacked and punished, then I'm going to stay here and do things that are going to make that happen.
Mm-hmm.
And why? What, you know, we talk about the, that ontological guilt. And I know Ken talked a lot about the ontological guilt and, you know, that, you know, we killed God and, you know, all that, which, you know, I do believe is the basis for all of it. But in my piddling little mind, I blame myself because the world is not a perfectly happy place. And somehow I think that it's my fault. So, you know, I don't sit around and say, oh, gee, God, I miss you. I'm lonely for you. Like our lesson today says, you know, I'm not saying I'm lonely for you, God. I'm saying, oh, I wish I could help those poor children that are starving. Oh my gosh, what can I do about this climate change? You know, why am I not able to, you know, do all the miraculous things that I, you know, would like to do for the world. If I could just win the lottery, I'd help you. You know, I mean, I have all these thoughts about what the problem is and what the solution is.
Mm-hmm. And we all do, so don't feel bad, basically.
Well,
right?
Yeah, we all do. Yeah. I mean, that's the way we live. But that's the guilt that I feel. I feel guilt because I do know that I can do, that I could see peace instead of this.
Mm-hmm.
And I choose to see this. And so you know, I'm always going to feel guilty when I see, you know, a starving child or, you know, people on drugs or, you know, anything. You know, I'm always going to feel guilty about it because I think it's my responsibility to save the world. Not, I mean, I don't literally think that, oh, gee, I should be saving the world. That's subconsciously in my mind, though, is that I shouldn't be allowing people to suffer like this. And so that's the guilt that I feel. And a lot of people don't, you know, a lot of people say, well, I don't feel guilty. I just think you're not looking if you're not feeling guilty. Because you're going to see a lot of places if you start looking where you're going to be saying, oh, gee, I'm sorry. I wish this didn't happen. I wish I could help you. You know, you see all the ways you feel helpless mm-hmm. in the world, and feeling helpless in the world is guilt. I mean, that's how guilt is.
I'm glad you mentioned that, Lynn, because I think that's an important point is that, you know, a lot of times because we have so many nuances and variations of different feelings and emotions in the world, and we think that they're different in terms of anything that's less than perfect peace. And because that's the ego strategy is to divide, we might tell ourselves, well, I don't feel any guilt. I think the whole idea and the whole premise, and it comes to us in A Course in Miracles in so many different ways, is that anything that's less than perfect peace is in the same basic category. And to try to make distinctions of well, let's see, today I'm feeling jealousy, and now that a few months later I'm feeling anxiety, and now I'm feeling, you know, annoyance, and then maybe there's some some fear, and, you know, so we have all these little, you know, if ultimately irrelevant distinctions of not at peace, and we do the same thing with, you know, when we truly are at ease and at peace and feeling an acceptance or a love of what truly is and what's eternal and what our real being is, those tend to be so fleeting that we, you know, for the most part, as, you know, just kind of generalizing, you know, the human experience, those things, we tend to fragment as well. So to say that, you know, I don't have guilt, the way I find this really practical is if I just look, am I completely at peace? That's usually a way to tell if there's unconscious guilt there. And it doesn't have to be, you know, a dictionary definition guilt kind of thing. And certainly not the way the world uses it, but the way the Course uses it is anything that is less than perfect peace is a result of a mistaken choice in the mind, for unfounded and unconscious guilt or fear or sin or, duality or division or divisiveness or, you know, basically the authority problem that A Course in Miracles talks about, which is that we believe that a separation from the Creator was possible, and we believe that it's certainly abundantly evident in our dream world if we use the ego's interpretation as it's handed to us on a silver platter. It's abundantly obvious from the ego's perspective that separation happened, because look at all these separate things. I mean, I normally think of myself as a separate person talking to another separate person who's in Colorado and other separate people who may be listening to this that are in other parts of this separate planet, which is separate from other galaxies, yada, yada. And it goes on and on. So it's an incredibly pervasive, matrix of propaganda that we all collectively, you know, fabricated, but this inner voice that of course Miracle talks about suggests that it's called Holy Spirit or Jesus as a symbolic representative of the awareness we took with us into the dream. That's our way out. We all have that option to listen to that perspective that suggests that just maybe there's another way of looking at this. I could see peace instead of this, and I'm not upset for the reason I think, because the real reason is that I chose the wrong teacher. And that's not a permanent thing. That can be undone any moment and every moment.
And I don't feel guilty for choosing the wrong teacher either.
Yeah. And the best way to, one of the best ways to undo guilt is to recognize when those twinges happen and say, ah, I don't need to go there. And I don't need to feel guilty about feeling guilty or about feeling upset of any sort. Instead, I can choose to let go of it, and I can choose to listen to that inner counsel that gently guides us, and with so much compassion and kindness, loving kindness within ourselves, that says, you know, there's really no reason to suffer, because there's a place in the mind that is always at peace, and you can go there anytime. And I think that's, you know, one of the ideas in A Course in Miracles that has appealed to me from the get-go is there's this awareness that I know is always there. It's always available, and I can turn to it anytime I feel the least little bit of upset, and know that I just have to acknowledge my complicity in choosing something that doesn't work, and then just, you know, back out of the cul-de-sac. I don't have to drive around in circles in a cul-de-sac the rest of eternity. I can just get back on the thoroughfare, back to the home that I never left, using that metaphor. So should we read a little bit of Gary's
book? Sure. So we're reading Gary Renard's latest book, which is The Lifetimes When Jesus and Buddha Knew Each Other, A History of Mighty Companions. And we're getting up there. We're on, what, page 157? And mm-hmm. I think you wanted to go back, or did we mark it back?
I think we basically got to 158, and I think I backed it up to the last paragraph of 157.
Okay, so why don't you read then?
Okay, all right. So this is where Gary's doing an extended monologue at the beginning of the ninth chapter, which is the importance of the mind Yeah, and again, this is Gary Renard's fourth book, The Lifetimes When Jesus and Buddha Knew Each Other, A History of Mighty Companions. And so Gary continues, I had noticed the last couple of years that there seemed to be a kind of mini movement afoot among a minority of students in the course community. Some people, certainly not a large percentage, but some seem to be depreciating the power and importance of the mind. Ever since A Course in Miracles was published in 1976 and the word got out that Helen Schuckman was channeling Jesus, a book would come every few years where the author would say they were also channeling Jesus. The followers of these books never seemed to hesitate to try to put them on the same level as the Course. But not only was the voice of Jay in these books nowhere as profound and beautiful as the voice of the Course, but after listening to my teachers during the series of visits, I realized these books were doing exactly the same thing they told me the world has always done with non-dualistic teachings. Devolve them into dualism. Rather than doing the Course, the authors apparently found it a lot easier to make up their own Course. And they were not committed to undoing their egos, which allowed the ego to block out the message of the Holy Spirit they said they were channeling. And a quick aside is I think that, you know, not to point the finger at certain specific literary works or whatever, but I think this is just an example of a more general practice that we all engage in as egos, which is basically the resistance to undoing the ego because we are really afraid of the the love, because it's the ultimate authority problem again. We're afraid of something, of recognizing that our true identity is something that we didn't make, but was created for us, as us, and we're all the same thing, which means our individuality, ultimately, as separate selves goes away. And that's the last thing that any, you know, self-disrespecting ego ever wants to look at.
Exactly.
Anyway, so not to sing, you know, he's singling out a few things here in specific, a category of a Me Too, knockoffs of, you know, Course, similar to the Course ideas, but, you know, not that there's anything wrong with those. And a lot of people get a lot of things out of a lot of books. And I certainly found my way to A Course in Miracles through the work of Marianne Williamson and Jerry Jampolsky and back in the, I learned about it in the mid-70s and finally got into it in the mid-80s. So, I mean, I'm very grateful to those. So there's nothing wrong with any of that. It's just that I think that if we really want to undo the ego, as Gary is suggesting here, we have to make that the primary emphasis, and that's done through forgiveness, which is looking at the insanity of the ego's curriculum and just saying no to it. Just, it's the not no, as Ken Wapnick would say.
Exactly. And if you actually if you read the Course and you pretty well understand what it is that Jesus is saying throughout the Course, he is saying, I will speak to you, I will talk to you. Helen said it herself that if you ask him, he would tell you things. But you have to really get yourself out of the way, mm-hmm. and opinions out of the way. And I think, because a lot of folks will read A Course in Miracles and say, well, I don't feel the love in that. There's no heart to that. You know, although to me, every word of it is like dripping with love. It's like so, so heartfelt throughout, you know. I mean, even saying, you know, we're lonely because we miss you, God, and God misses me, and He loves me and wants to embrace me, and you know, I mean, that's, I think there's a lot of love involved in that. But you know, some people may read it and think that this is all about guilt and forgiveness, and you know, it's you know, has, you know, they associate it with harsh things that are not that love of God within me now feeling, and so you know, they want to have that feeling. And so, you know, then they look for a Jesus that's going to make them feel that way. But, you know, that Jesus is going to, because they don't want to give up, their love in the world, their family, their love of the earth or the love of beautiful things, they don't want to give that up. And they think that Jesus is asking them to do that when he says give up the world. They're thinking that he's asking them to give up their love. And And so they need to have a Jesus that's going to tell them, you can keep your love, keep the world. You can, you know, you, and that is one thing that the one, the course of love actually does, you know, eventually say, yeah, this world is really a real physical place. And, you know, it gets a little goofy that way. So if it directly contradicts what you've already seen in A Course in Miracles, but it makes you feel better because, it more suits your point of view, then you're just going to make a mistake and a lot of other people are going to follow you in that mistake. Not that there's anything wrong with that either. I mean, we could do that for billions of years. We've done it for billions of years.
We have. Nothing new under the sun here.
But you know, here we have, I mean, really honestly, I can't even imagine how anything could be more perfect than A Course in Miracles. In its perfect consistency and perfect continuity, and you know, there is nothing, it doesn't contradict itself no matter what people may think, because it's written on levels. There are basically two levels that it's written on. One is a level of ego and ego understanding, and it's talking to the ego because that's the only thing that needs to hear. The Holy Spirit sure doesn't need to hear A Course in Miracles, but the ego needs to be hearing it and being convinced of the possibility and the truth of it. So the Course is written for the ego, and so... You can use it to show you the truth and reality of what you are, in opposition to what the world is telling you and what, so anyway, what I'm saying is, if you dislike the initial premise that says there is no world, and none of this that you think here is real or true, including your love and your family and your children and the earth, all that. And if you look at that and feel like you're being asked to give something up, that you're being deprived of something, that something is going to be lost because of giving into this teaching that Jesus has given us, then you might be very afraid. And, is that my daughter? No, that's Walmart. I don't need these. They're just telling me my prescription's ready. So where was I? Okay, so I guess what I'm saying is, if you just read the Course and you do what it tells you and you, you do the lessons and you do what they tell you, you know, don't, you know, say I did the lesson because I read it in the morning. You know, do what he's telling you to do in it, and it will transform you, and you will begin to see, and you will begin to have confidence in the truth and peace of what is, and you are then not going to want to change the Course to make it more palatable to the ego. You're going to want to enforce the Course because it is the truth, or as close to the truth as you can get in this illusion. And so I guess, you know, it's just like, you know, I know Ken talked about this and I've read about it and I've seen it. You know, people picked up the book the first time they saw it and went and said, I'm going to be a teacher now, and started up groups. You know, they hadn't even read the book and they were already being experts in it. And that's perfectly fine too. You know, you don't have to be an expert in it, because if you're open your heart and mind, the Holy Spirit speak through you, then, you know, you can, but you still have to do the work. You know, you can't, if you could just let go of this world, then it would be a different thing, but we can't. We're so believing this is my body. This is who I am. It started when I was a baby. I came out of my mother's womb. I didn't know the difference between anything. And how long was it before I found out that this is me? And that is you, and we are different, and I'm not attached to you. I mean, that's what we spend our lives learning, how separate we are. And so to unlearn that and to come into a place where we see ourselves as one, it takes a lot of letting go and forgiveness. Anyway.
It does. It does. You know, to your comment a moment ago, Lynn, about you know, the giving up and the idea of sacrifice. There's absolutely nothing in A Course in Miracles that suggests that sacrifice is necessary or even advisable. It's not an ascetic course, and it doesn't make any suggestions one way or the other about behavior. So it's really, and in fact, it points out many times that the only sacrifice, which is kind of a tongue-in-cheek use of the word, is you know, that you know, or a whimsical, I don't know what the best adjective is, but it's you know, basically saying, let's use your language and say that, you know, that the only real sacrifice is to sacrifice the suffering. And that's basically something that egos don't want to do, because egos think they get some mileage out of suffering. So the course would certainly have absolutely nothing against doing common sense things to take care of your health, your finances, your relationships, your country's political system, your ecology, your, you know, all those things that are just kind of common sense stuff. It doesn't say don't do those. It just says don't take anything in the dream of space-time seriously. And in terms of your identity, certainly as a persona, it's appropriate for us to do all the things that care for and attend to the stuff in the world, but just not to get upset about it. If our identity is really above the battleground, or if it's independent of what seems to happen in this world of space-time, that we each seem to have crafted our own little personal hellish dramatizations out of, then if we can just remember to not take it seriously, and to give ourselves some slack when we go off on these tangents and we find something that seems to be, you know, a great solution to making the world work. You know, chapter 31, the real alternative says, you know, perhaps you'd like to try all the different, you know, alternatives to truth first, you know, basically I'm paraphrasing greatly, but, you know, be the first on your block to try them all, you know, kind of thing. But no, the idea is just to look at the fact ultimately that they're all the same, but to not beat yourself up when you say, okay, I still am resistant to that love that would, ultimately lead to, getting rid of something I think is going to work. And it's as Ken Wapnick so beautifully points out in so many ways, it's not evil, sinful, or wicked. It's just silly. And that phrase has stuck with me because I think it's so important that, you know, there's nothing wrong with any of the things that we do in the world, because the world is a neutral dream. How could a neutral dream affect reality? And it doesn't. So how about if I go on with where we left
Absolutely.
Off?
Absolutely.
Okay. I was sometimes reading incredible statements from people who describe themselves as course students, such as, quote, we've got to get away from the mind. It's the ego mind that caused the problem in the first place. We can't look for the answer there, unquote. Another said, the Holy Spirit is passé, unquote. And yet another, quote, thank God we don't have to study the course anymore, unquote. Although the overwhelming majority of students had enormous respect for Helen, Bill, Ken, and Judy, there was a small group who seemed resentful, even jealous of them, and would accuse them of being, quote, beginner students, unquote, who, quote, edited out a large amount of the course's deepest teachings, unquote. The truth is, there was some editing of the course in the first five chapters of the text. The editing was done by Jesus through Helen, with Ken acting as her assistant. His contribution was helping with subchapter titles, consistent capitalization, and punctuation. And the text doesn't have five chapters, it has 31 chapters. The deepest and most important teachings are found in the later parts of the text. And that's not even counting the workbook, which aside from having 365 daily lessons, also contains some of the clearest explanations of the course's principles. Then there's the Manual for Teachers, which offers a brilliant summary of ACIM. Those last two books are half the course. The latest course imitation that I noticed distracting people from actually doing the course was called A Course of Love. since you were just mentioning that a few moments ago. Gary goes into this a little bit. The publisher, without permission from the course publisher, was promoting it as, quote, a continuation of A Course in Miracles, unquote, saying it was dictated by the same voice. A continuation implied it was a step forward, an improvement. The publisher said, quote, remarkably, it bypasses the mind, unquote, allowing you to, quote, access the heart's knowing, unquote, leading to, quote, the new reality of heaven and earth, unquote. I had met the author and heard her say in public that she doesn't believe this world is an illusion. I was dumbfounded that some people, they said they were longtime course students, were singing the praises of this new dualistic distraction, and I looked forward to talking with Art and Peirce about it. Then I came across a review that was written by A Course of Love, about A Course of Love, by Dr. Bob Dahl, a psychiatrist who was one of the earliest students of A Course in Miracles and a close friend of Bill, Dr. William Thetford, the co-scribe of the course. And a quick aside, in the last couple of years, Dr. Bob, who I worked with at Foundation for Inner Peace, can't say enough good things about Bob. He is now one of the co-presidents of the Foundation for Inner Peace and is helping, taking a more active role in getting our website launched, which is hopefully going to happen in the next few weeks. Stay tuned. So, end of aside. Okay. Bob is also a longtime member of the board of directors of the Foundation for Inner Peace. Okay. Publishers of the course. I had read and endorsed his excellent book published by Hay House called From Plagues to Miracles. And it is indeed an excellent book. If you haven't read it, I highly recommend it too. I realized that Bob had expressed my sentiments about A Course of Love even better than I could. One more quick aside. If you go to acimblog.com, I have two back-to-back conversations about Bob's book From Plagues to Miracles with Bob. And he describes, and we talk about the first and second parts of his that book, and wonderful conversations with Bob. I recommend those if you want to find out a little bit more about that book without picking it up and seeing if it's something you resonate with.
Awesome. And also, he was at the Course in Miracles conference in San Francisco this last year with Tamara. Uh-huh. And I think they are going to be speaking at the Course in Miracles conference in Boston next year in May.
Okay.
So.
Okay. Well, a lot more to say about that, but I'll go on. Okay. I realized that Bob had expressed my sentiments about A Course of Love even better than I could. I was struck by how his writing matched the descriptions that Art and Peirce had given of the world's desire to change dualistic teachings into the non-dual. I'm reprinting it here with his permission. I have vacillated for months about whether or not to review this book. As a long-standing student of A Course in Miracles, ACIM, a personal friend of one of its scribes, a board member of the foundation that publishes ACIM, and the author of a book that reinterprets the story of Exodus through the lens of ACIM, From Plagues to Miracles, the transformational journey of Exodus, from the slavery of ego to the promised land of spirit, I was intrigued by this book's claims to extend ACIM's teachings and to do so in a more accessible manner. So I bought the book and began to read. Standing on its own, A Course of Love, ACOL, is a fine work with much to offer its readers. It is well written in a style similar to that of many channeled works, although I found the voice to be nothing like that of ACIM, falling short in both its revelatory power and its beauty. But here's the problem. ACOL, A Course of Love, does not stand on its own. It positions itself as a, quote, continuation of the coursework provided in A Course in Miracles, unquote. That is, in fact, its selling point. When we compare the two teachings, however, ACOL turns out not to be an extension of the principles of ACIM, but rather a simplification and retreat from those principles. It might serve as a good primer for those still too threatened by the radical non-dual worldview of ACIM, or for those with no interest in ACIM. But for students of the course, it offers more confusion than clarity. I am frankly puzzled by the reception it has garnered in some corners of the ACIM community, and it is this that has prompted me to post such a detailed review. I feel it is imperative for novice students to understand the significant differences between these two spiritual works, which I'll attempt to elucidate below. The foreword to ACOL states that, quote, it emphasizes being who you are in a way that does not negate the personal self or the body. It reveals how the human form can be transformed into, subquote, the elevated self of form, unquote, and how an illusory world will be made new, divine, through relationship and unity, unquote. This is not an extension of the non-dual teaching of ACIM, but a regression back into duality. ACIM teaches that the individual self with which we've identified, housed in a body and doomed to die, is an illusion, a dream of separation, which it is our task to heal through forgiveness and vision that sees not the body, personality, or past history of our brothers and sisters, but the oneness that shines from behind and beyond them all. It is only this oneness of love of God and God's creations that truly exists. This is the only reality that ever was or will be. It lives outside of linear time and has no connection with the ego's illusory world of form and bodies. And in parentheses, except that it is reflected here, illusion lacks the power to banish or hide truth entirely. End of parenthetical phrase. If ACOL manages then to, quote, negate the personal self or the body, and, unquote, and to somehow make the illusory world into something new and desirable, then despite its claims to the contrary, it is not a non-dual system. This has its appeal. It is certainly more comfortable and less threatening to us because it does not challenge the sense of self with which we've all grown familiar. It lets us continue to live our lives as if we were egos and bodies, with the assurance that it is perfectly okay that we can still find redemption as such. But this view is contrary to ACIM, which would in fact regard it as a profound obstacle to awakening. ACOL states, quote, the Christ in you is wholly human and wholly divine. It is this joining of the human and the divine that ushers in love's presence. It is this joining of the human and the divine that is your purpose here. 5.1, end of quote. This is contrary to ACIM. We may use the human to teach that the mind is the only reality and that all mind is one, i.e. minds are joined through the process of forgiveness. But in order to reveal love's presence, we must remove the obstacles to its awareness, namely our desire to be special beings, separate from God and from each other, and not by, quote, joining the human and divine, unquote, which is not even possible according to ACIM. ACOL maintains that, quote, God is union and, quote, God creates all relationship, unquote, and that, quote, reality, the true, truly real is relationship, unquote. It elevates relationship and union to the level of God. God does not support this. The, quote, truly real, unquote, is God and only God. After all, oneness and union are not identical, nor are oneness and relationship. Relationship and union both imply separate entities interrelated or linked together or united completely. Relationship may be the vehicle for achieving oneness, but it is not oneness itself, nor, according to ACIM, did God create it, as God creates only wholeness. To be fair, there is also much in ACOL that is completely in line with ACIM, such as, quote, your mind is not contained within your body, but is one with God and shared equally with all alike, unquote. Or, quote, judgment is the function that the separated mind has given itself, unquote. I suspect this is why ACOL appeals to some ACIM students. But it's also why I would not recommend ACOL to students of ACIM. Unless you've studied and practiced ACIM for years, ACOL will likely confuse you. Truth mixed with half-truth does not equal greater truth. Rather, it dilutes and muddles the teaching until what you're left with is no longer pure, no longer truth. ACOL, in its attempt to preserve some value for the individual self and body, some purpose other than fully awakening from the dream of separation, commits the error of what ACIM calls, quote, bringing truth to illusion, unquote. ACIM's goal is the opposite, to bring illusions to truth where they disappear. To quote ACIM, quote, there is no part of heaven, truth, you can take and weave into illusions, nor is there one illusion you can enter heaven with, unquote. That's from chapter 22 in the text. Our task is to learn to recognize that the world we see offers nothing of lasting value. that every aspect of this illusory dream world of form will hurt us and block us from awakening to our true radiant self at one with God and love. The description for A Course of Love promises that, quote, ACIM and ACOL are complementary, the same voice more accessible, the same thought system expanded, unquote. But looked at honestly, this is not the case. Neither the voice nor the thought system really mirror that of ACIM. On the other hand, any teaching that encourages us to look with love upon the world, to suspend judgment, and to value relationship over individual endeavor is worthy of study and dissemination. I only wish the author and the publisher had not felt the need to promote their book on the back of ACIM. And I'll just finish this last little paragraph and then we can go on. How's that sound? Okay. I was grateful for Bob's review, and I hoped it would encourage students to stick with the non-dualistic truth of the Course. He had very clearly made his points that ACOL is not a continuation of the Course, but a step backward, that ACOL would have us believe that the world of form is God's creation, which ACIM would certainly not support, and that ACOL's notion of, quote, the elevated self of form, unquote, which is a melding of the, quote, human and divine, the individual and the universal, unquote, in no way resembles the approach of the Course. I realized that now I wouldn't have to ask Art and Persa as many questions about it as I thought. Soon my uncompromising ascended teachers were sitting in front of me once again. Persa began the discussion. So do you want to go from there or comment anything?
The comments. I did read Bob Rosenthal's review of ACOL and found, he very clearly saw things as I did, so he must be right. But I had started teaching this with a friend here on Gather several years ago, and she's a good friend of Mari Peron, so she wanted me to go through the book with her. But as I was going through the book with her, I was discovering this very thing and trying to reconcile in my mind, how can this be the same? And it didn't last long. It wasn't something that, once I realized, I could be going through anything right now, and, where there's truth, I can see it. And, but if it's telling me that the world is really real and this, this form, it's like, I meet and know Course in Miracles students who are insistent that the body will live forever, or can live forever, and that the death of the body is absolutely an attack on God and wrong, and so when Course students die, if they have been teachers or whatever, these same people, they're the same people that say if you got cancer, you must not be getting it. If you die, obviously you didn't get it. They're completely seeing things from a point of view that is contrary to the very teaching of the Course. And that's what I see with A Course of Love. A lot of it, yes, is really beautiful stuff, and I can agree with, because it echoes A Course in Miracles. But then there are these little things that come up that, as you're reading along, you're recognizing, this could be easily leading me into a belief that there's something I can do. There are Course in Miracles students who believe that we must do something, and that listen, learn, and do is Jesus's battle cry. When Jesus very clearly tells us throughout the Course, you need do nothing. The Course in Miracles students are not perfect, or they wouldn't still be students, I guess. but if you like books and you want to read them, and I have nothing, they're beautiful and poetic, but I think I agree with Bob. Mm-hmm. It's not the uncompromising non-duality that I have come to know and expect from A Course in Miracles.
Right. Yeah, and there's, again, there's nothing wrong. There's no need for any kind of condemnation or judgment. It's just basically an acknowledgement that the premises and what is shared is a mix rather than an undiluted content that A Course in Miracles has. And again, we're never talking about the form, but the content, which is the pure non-dual teaching that is behind it. And I think we get that from reading the Course, and I think that's why, you know, both Martin Person and Gary and Bob, all, you know, most of the people that I've talked to about it that have mostly who study with Ken Wapnick, I would say, and Gary's teachings would suggest that the pure non-dual teaching really is the way out, ultimately. And, you know, there's nothing wrong with taking the smorgasbord, buffet tour, you know, trying, what works and then trying what doesn't work and going back until you realize, well, ultimately, well, the only thing that's really going to truly satisfy us is to abandon all the different strategies of the ego and to, you know, just basically say there's nothing to condemn here. It's just there's something to let go of and to say, you know, that's just silly to try to make that work in a place where it can never work. Just like our cutting up back to our Sisyphus metaphor from the beginning of our conversation. You know, it's just why should I identify with the Sisyphus character? I can still be doing all the daily things that I do, the chores, the errands, my seemingly infinite task lists for each day. There's nothing wrong with doing those things. It's not about, you know, the Course doesn't advocate, I need do nothing at level four. It just says, as spirit, I need do nothing. And it's talking always and only about the mind. So it's addressing that decision-making point in the mind. And I think that's something that Ken brilliantly points out in so much of his work that it's never, he's never talking to the Bruce or the Lim characters. He's talking to the decision-making faculty in our mind that chooses against the insanity of identifying with the individual and it's gently and patiently suggests that we identify with the eternal that we all share. And that's what leads us out of the quagmire, right?
That's exactly what leads us out of the quagmire. And it looks like we are just about out of time. I don't think there's really any point of starting.
No, this is probably a good place to pick up next time. Yeah.
So I'm going to mark my Kindle here, and I don't know, anything going on in the world of Bruce that you'd like to announce to?
Oh, I had a nice conversation with Jackie Laura Jones the other day. We're doing once a month now on her Blog Talk Radio series, and also, let's see, what else? Oh, I had a good conversation with Maria Felipe a couple of weeks ago on her show. And, those you can find online, and I'm always reachable through acimblog.com and through the Facebook page of the same, the ACIM blog Facebook page. So, and I will be, soon, very soon, I think I may be catching it up to where I can focus my attention on this is helping with the Miracle Share Conference and getting that, ready to launch more officially for the October event, which I'll be participating with along with Bob Rosenthal. And I'm happy to report that Judy Scott Schwitzen, is going to be participating. I get to interview her in person, in a couple of weeks and, in Marin County, Northern California.
Wow.
So that'll
what
be fun. Flies.
You are the luckiest man.
I'm very grateful that things keep happening like that. So yeah, I'm very much looking forward to being with Judy and all the folks at FIP for a day or part of a day, I guess, in the next couple of weeks. And, so that's probably enough for now. So anyway, thank you, Lynn. Thank you all, and have a great week, and we'll pick up where we left off next time.
Absolutely. And Dove is asking where the interview of Judy is. You haven't interviewed her yet.
That hasn't happened yet, but I'll
that has happened.
It will be on the Miracle Share Conference as part of one of the 30-minute segments of the Miracle Share Conference, and that will be made available soon in terms of the being able to log in and get access to that as soon as we have that ready to go. So.
Very cool.
Details forthcoming.
So are you planning to go down there to see her and do this? Or?
Yes, only because, I learned a couple of weeks ago that my mom, who's not driving much anymore, says, "Would you like a car?" And so I said, "Sure." So I'm going to fly down and then drive back. So that's how that's going to happen.
You are the luckiest man.
I'm very fortunate. I was thrilled to learn that she wanted to give me her car that she's not using it. It's, anyway, so that's fun. Yeah.
I love it.
And
I'll
get to visit with my mom and Judy and everyone there at FIP. So, yeah, so it'll be fun. Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Bruce Rawls. And, I bless the day I met you. It's, you know, what a gift, and, you know, how lucky we are.
Likewise.
To have each other, mighty companions here. So,
you do, Lynn. I know it's you, you're a very busy person with doing online, making online gifts about the course and in so many ways. So, yeah.
All right. Love you, Bruce. I'll talk to you next week.
Likewise.
All right. Going to hang up.